Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by OU Israel. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Korach, which is also Rosh Chodesh Tammuz, the first of 2 days of Rosh Chodesh, to be specific, being the 30th day of the month of Sivan, 5767. In the secular calendar, today, the day of this recording and first broadcast, is the 14th of June, if I'm not mistaken, and my memory is not playing tricks. It is Flag Day in the United States, but that's another story. Actually, I'll share a personal anecdote with you. My mother, Aleha HaShalom, used to crochet kippot for her sons and others, and she made one in the style of an American flag. It had a 6-point blue star with 50 white dots on it, surrounded by 13 concentric circles, stripes, red and white alternating. That American flag kippah I used to wear on Flag Day, July 4th, maybe Memorial Day also, but it mostly was a novelty item that she had made. She made another one, and we actually presented it to Senator Jacob Javits, Zichrono Livracha, and I don't know who else has one like it, but he did, and I do. Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir ha-ma'alot mima'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli, tehiena aznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avono tishmorya Adonai miya amod. Ki imecha hasalicha lema'an tivarei. Kiviti Adonai kiveta nafshi velidvaro hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai, mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbeimo fedut. Vehu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achinu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzarao vashivya, ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha'makom yirachem aleihem, v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha umi'afela la'ora umi'shibud l'geula, hashta ba'gala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. Having Rosh Chodesh and Shabbat coincide is not a rare event. It happens 2 or 3 times a year. Yet each time it happens, it's a special day to celebrate. And I would like to put this perspective on it. It's a nice partnership between the two. Shabbat represents God's sanctification of time. He created the world in 6 days. He rested on the seventh. The Torah tells us, therefore, he blessed the seventh day and made it holy. He commands us to acknowledge that holiness by prohibition of melacha, various categories of activities, by the saying of kiddush as Shabbat enters, havdalah as it exits. But in essence, Shabbat is his, capital H, his act of sanctification of time, and then commanding us and wanting us to respond to that sanctity of time by the observance of Shabbat. Then we have Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh began before the nation began, when we were still in Egypt, and God said to Moshe and to Aharon in the land of Egypt, saying, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim. This month will be the first of your months, Rishon Hulachem L'Chodshei Hashana. It is the first of the months of the year. It refers to the month of Nisan, the month in which we came out of Egypt, and it is considered the source of the mitzvah to establish a Jewish calendar, to sanctify Rosh Chodesh according to the guidelines set down by God, set down in the Halacha, and to form the calendar and the holidays in the calendar and other dates based upon the sanctity of Rosh Chodesh. Now, even though Rosh Chodesh is related to the cycle of the moon around the earth and going through its phases, the moon having been created by God, the earth having been created by God, the phases of the moon, God's creation, all of the laws of nature, etc., etc., and yet God, who did not need to do this, so to speak, took the people of Israel into partnership with him on this concept of sanctity of time. In other words, this is the way I like to put it, first he sanctified Shabbat, and we perpetuate that concept of sanctity every single week throughout the year, year after year after year, every seventh day, it is Shabbat. Then God said, I want you, the Jewish people, to be involved in the active sanctification of time. Shabbat, this is what you're supposed to do, but when it comes to Rosh Chodesh, HaChodesh Hazeh Lochem, it is yours. Rishon Hu Lochem L'Chodshei Hashana, the first of your months. The strong implication, and it's really more than that, is that we, the Jewish people, are the ones who sanctify Rosh Chodesh and therefore give sanctity to the dates of the year that are Kodesh, that are sacred, according to divine command. And that ups the situation one significant notch. God sanctified Shabbat and commanded us how to behave on Shabbat. God commanded us to sanctify Rosh Chodesh on the Jewish calendar. And therefore, we have a partnership with God in this very important concept of sanctity of time. When Shabbat and Rosh Chodesh coincide, it becomes a very, very special, sacred day. Not that Shabbat is not sacred on its own. It is. Rosh Chodesh has a sanctity of a lesser nature than Shabbat. When the days coincide, the Kedusha is elevated, and maybe one of the things that I am suggesting is that we spend time this Shabbat talking about time, the preciousness of time, the seriousness of wasting time, the value of preserving time and using time well. I might add, just to give a fuller picture of the situation, that around Shabbat, even though it was God's act of sanctification and our following his command in acknowledging that sanctity, we also have a command to take a little bit of our secular profane week and make it Kodesh too, attach it to Shabbat. So we have the concept called Tosefet Shabbat, adding to the Shabbat. It exists before Shabbat, and it exists right after Shabbat, and it enlarges the sanctity of Shabbat. Before, let me just add one more thing here. The fact that we have a halachic question as to when a day actually begins, when does daytime end and nighttime begin, which would signal the beginning of the next day? Is it from the moment the sun sets, or is it from when the light of the sun leaves the sky, the time that we call Tzeit HaKochavim, stars out? That period between sunset and stars out is known as twilight, in Hebrew, Bein Hashmashot. And it has a status of Sufik Yom, Sufik Laila. Maybe it's daytime, maybe it's nighttime. And because of the seriousness of the prohibitions of Shabbat, one may not do any manner of melacha after sunset, even though you might argue that it's still light outside and it's not yet really Shabbat. It is. So, as a minimum, we add to Shabbat the period of twilight before and the period of twilight at the end of Shabbat. Because possibly when the sun sets on what the world calls Saturday, Shabbat might be over, but we wait a significant amount of time until it is very dark out, or until three stars appear in different parts of the sky, etc., etc., before we are able to finish with Shabbat and recite Havdalah. So already the 24 hours of Shabbat, for technical reasons of doubt, are up to close to 25 hours. And then we add a little bit more at the beginning, because when we accept Shabbat, it should be before sunset, so that we are adding even more of our weekday, our chol, to the Shabbat and making it holy. So this concept of sanctity of time is definitely an issue with Shabbat, and it is an issue with Rosh Chodesh. And as I said, we've got a Shabbat Rosh Chodesh coming up. We take out two Torah scrolls this Shabbat. In the first Torah we read the seven portions of Parshat Korach, the regular weekly Sedra. And in the second Torah we read a special Maftir that comes from Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, chapter 28, in Parshat Pinchas, where we read about Shabbat and Rosh Chodesh. It's the only time we do that. In other words, when Pesach, a day of Pesach, falls out on Shabbat, we have a Haftorah, we have a Maftir, which is about the Korban Musaf, the additional sacrifice of Pesach, and even though it's Shabbat, we don't mention that it is Shabbat in the Maftir, because the Shabbat portion and the Pesach portion, for example, are not continuous. But Shabbat is followed by Rosh Chodesh in the Torah in that context of the Musaf, the additional sacrifices, and therefore, when Shabbat is Rosh Chodesh, we read both the two-verse Shabbat portion and the five-verse Rosh Chodesh portion. As we're fleshing out this picture, to add the following: at Arvit, at Shacharit, and at Mincha, we acknowledge Rosh Chodesh within the Shabbat davening. In other words, the services are Shabbat-oriented. We add the passage called Ya'alev Yavo and refer to Yom Rosh Chodesh Hazeh, this day of Rosh Chodesh. But in the Chatima, the concluding part of the Bracha, in the middle of the Amidah, we just say Mikadesh HaShabbat, God who sanctifies the Shabbat. When we daven Musaf, the additional service, as we do every Shabbat, we do not use the standard Shabbat Musaf and add acknowledgement of Rosh Chodesh. It becomes a combined Shabbat Rosh Chodesh Musaf, where the Chatima of the Bracha, the conclusion of that blessing, the middle one of the Amidah, is Mekadesh HaShabbat V'Yisrael V'Roshei Chodoshim. He who has sanctified the Shabbat, the people of Israel, and Rosh Chodesh. And notice, on Shabbat, it is Mekadesh HaShabbat, God who sanctifies Shabbat, parenthetically, which we don't voice there, and commanded us to keep it. On Rosh Chodesh, and on holidays as well, it's Mekadesh HaShabbat, God who sanctifies the Shabbat, Yisrael, the people of Israel, and Rosh Chodesh, or and the holidays, because it is we who are the prime partners who take care of the sanctity of Yom Tov and of Rosh Chodesh, of course, at God's instruction, and we are still junior partners to Him. But it's an important concept, an important idea. Putting Shabbat and Rosh Chodesh together, and especially since this week it's not only Shabbat, but Motzoi Shabbat Sunday, that is also Rosh Chodesh, I would like to play a song we've played in the past. I have two versions of it, and hopefully we'll have chance to do both of them, but we'll start with one. The words come from the Zmirot, the songs of Motzoi Shabbat, from a Zemira known as Bimotsoi Yom Menucha, at the departure of the Day of Contentment, and two of the stanzas read as follows. Yehi HaChodesh Hazeh, may this month, Kinevuat Avi Chozeh, may it be like the prophecy of Moses, the father of prophets, of seers, V'yishama b'bayit zeh, and it shall be heard in this house, kol sason v'kol simcha, the sound of joy and the sound of gladness. Chazak yemalei mishaloteinu. Chazak means the strong one, another name of God. May he fulfill our requests. Amitz, another name of God, the firm one. Ya'aseh bakashateinu. May he implement our prayers. V'hu yishlach b'maseh yadeinu, and he will send into our handiwork bracha v'hatzlacha, blessing and success. I've always found these words interesting because it is a weekly prayer for a good month. Think about that and enjoy it.
Yeah, I'm
So that's the story. We need a good week. We need a good year. We need a good month. We could use good days one after the other, and a lot of good hours as well. So that should always be in our prayers to God, and with the recognition that He made us His partner, we have a significant head start. It isn't, by the way, just the Torah reading, the second Torah reading that points to Shabbat and Rosh Chodesh. It's the Haftarah as well. You know that the regular weekly Haftarah of Korach this week is preempted by the special Haftarah for Shabbat Rosh Chodesh. And again, unlike the other special Haftarot, which deal only with whatever it is, Pesach, Shavuot, etc., and whatever link is made without specific reference to Shabbat, here we feel the combination of the two. We're talking about the last chapter in the book of Yeshayahu, chapter 66. The next to the last verse is repeated after the last verse, so we say it twice at the end of the Haftarah. V'haya midei chodesh b'chodesho, it came to pass, or it shall come to pass, month after month, u'midei Shabbat b'Shabbato. And from Shabbat to Shabbat means week in and week out, yavo chol basar lishtachavot lifonai, omar Hashem, that all people will come to bow before me, says God. So you have reference to chodesh b'chodesho and Shabbat b'Shabbato. You've been listening to Torah Tidbits Audio for Parshat Korach, which is Rosh Chodesh. We've spent a lot of time on the Rosh Chodesh aspect. Let's get down to Korach. It is kind of depressing to have read 2 weeks ago in Parshat Beha'alotcha about various and sundry times which we angered and irked God, followed by Parshat Shlach with the ultimate slap in God's face of the sin of the spies. In essence, what happened there was God said, I'm taking you out of Egypt to give you the Torah, to bring you to Eretz Yisrael. And we said, no, we're not going. Terrible, terrible. And God there not only rebukes and punishes the people, but He says, this is the 10th time that you have angered me or tested me in the Midbar. And commentaries count out the various times. Why did you take us out of Egypt to bury us here in the Midbar? We're dying of thirst. We want food. We don't like this food. We want different food. We want meat. Various and sundry times. And when the Torah says, this is the 10th time, and you will die out in the course of the next 40 years, and only your children will go into Eretz Yisrael, you would think that's enough. And in fact, Chet HaMeraglim in last week's Sedra is followed by the command, when you come to Eretz Yisrael and you bring Korbanot, you bring Minachot with them and libation, and there's the mitzvah of Challah when you come to Eretz Yisrael, even though it applies all over, and all kind of good stuff that Parshat Shlach finished with. Okay. You turn over a new page, figuratively as well as literally, and this is what you're confronted with. Vayikach Korach, Korach takes, who's Korach ben Yitzhar ben Kahat ben Levi, who are his partners in this rebellion, Datan and Aviram, and On ben Pelet, also of Bnei Reuven, and On ben Pelet backs out before things get bad, but Datan v'Aviram remain the arrogant antagonists of Moshe Rabbeinu, rebelling against him and against God. Note that Korach had a bone or two to pick with Moshe Rabbeinu, and his rebellion is based on some kind of logic and reason. And then you have Datan and Aviram, who seem to take any opportunity to fight against Moshe, ever since that day that he stopped them from fighting with each other back in Egypt. And their arrogance and defiance carries with it a terrible insult to God and to Israel when they say to Moshe tauntingly, "What, you took us out of the land flowing with milk and honey, Egypt? And you certainly didn't bring us to any land flowing with milk and honey, so we're not going to listen to you." I don't know if I want to dwell now upon the content of the rebellion of Korach, because I want to point out that right in the aftermath of it, when the earth opens up and swallows the rebels, and fire from heaven takes the lives of the incense offerers that Korach recruited for his challenge on Moshe and on God, it is the people who were basically bystanders to this rebellion of Korach against Moshe. They're the ones that come to complain the next day to Moshe and to Aaron, saying, "You killed the people of God." In essence, they were saying, it wasn't Korach's fault, it's your fault. And this gets Moshe and Aaron very upset, needless to say, and it gets God very angry. Because God again says, "Hey, Romu mitoch ha'ida hazot, stand back from this group, va'achale otam keraga, and I'll wipe them out in one instant." And Moshe does not even have words of prayer to intercede on behalf of the people. He says to Aharon, "Take a fire pan, put a glowing coal on it from the Mizbeach, put incense on it, and go quickly to the people and bring about a redemption, an atonement for what they've done, because God is very, very angry." And the Torah tells us that there was a death toll of 14,700, aside from those who died in Korach's rebellion. And I'll say again, all of this is after 10 times, culminating in the Chet HaMeraglim, which included in its earlier stage Chet HaEgel. And here you could say, okay, it wasn't the people, it was Korach rabble-rousing and getting people to join him. But then after Korach and Datan and Aviram and their ilk are put in their place, the people again rise up against God, and his anger, so to speak, results in a plague which wipes out 14,700 and is stopped only because of the quick action, if you could say it like that, of Moshe and Aaron. That's what I meant by depressing. So it goes to the next stage. God says to Moshe, "Speak to the people of Israel, and each tribe shall present you with a rod, a staff, and on it shall be written the name of the tribe, and the name of Aaron should be written on the staff of Shevet Levi. And put these into Ohel Moed Lifnei Ha'edut, before the Aron. This is done, and the following day the staff of Shevet Levi with Aaron's name on it has blossomed and flowered, and the others remain barren. Moshe brings these rods out from Ohel Moed to the people of Israel, and they see them, and each tribe takes its staff back. God says to Moshe, put Aharon's staff back into Ohel Moed. It shall be a sign of this rebellion, and people will cease to complain and stop dying. Moshe does such as God has commanded him. And now what? The people react with despair. And the rest of the Sedra basically sets down laws concerning behavior of Kohanim, of Levim, of Yisraelim to the Kohen and to the Levi and the Levi to the Kohen. Because basically that's the point. Korach's rebellion was challenging the hierarchy of authority in Bnei Yisrael as God set it down, and they were punished for it, the people were castigated for it and threatened by it, and now the laws are set down clearly, distinguishing what a Kohen does, what a Levi does, what a Kohen receives, what a Levi receives, and what are our obligations towards them. The Sedra does not let up until the end. The last words of the Sedra, V'lo tamutu, and you shall not die if you follow orders. Very harsh. I don't really have many words of consolation here. You can say that it was the Asafsuf, the Erev Rav, the Egyptians that came along with Bnei Israel when they left, seeing a good thing and taking advantage of it. They were very much the rabble-rousers. But I don't know if you could say that here, because Korach was a well-connected individual. He was a Levi, he was a first cousin of Moshe and Aharon. Datan Vaviram, on the other hand, as I mentioned, they had their problems with Moshe throughout. But it's a tough situation. Some of the commentaries chalk it up to the slave mentality that developed over years and years of Egyptian servitude, over generations of enslavement. And these are our feelings and character that's very difficult to uproot. It had to be only the next generation, the ones that were born in freedom in the wilderness, or the ones that were young enough when they left Egypt not to have been implanted with that slave mentality. They are the ones that could continue into the land of Israel and get going on Jewish life there. And we know their track record too. So I could smile about it and still have a very heavy heart about it. I don't really have any good things to report. I hate to get political about it, but I think part of my mood that's coloring the way I present even Parshat HaShavua are the latest doings in Israel with the selection of a president who, let's say, I was disappointed to hear that he was selected. I don't like the idea that only 120 people vote for president of the country, as symbolic and as ceremonial a position as it is. It's still an important position. I don't like the idea that an individual who's not even a member of the Knesset has 7 votes in order to command to vote for who he would like, and I'm not going to get into that, especially not with Parshat Shlach in the background of speaking ill of the land of Israel. I have no intention of doing that. As people say here, Yihye Tov, things will work out for the better. But in the meantime, it gets hard sometimes. Having already said more than enough on that, let me change to a topic. I might have discussed this in the past too, but it jumps out at me from the pages of Parshat Korach and elsewhere in the Torah. One of the mitzvot that relates to the gifts to the Kohen from the people are the different types of Bechor, firstborn. There's a human firstborn. The mitzvah is learned from Parshat Korach that one is to redeem the child at following 30 days of his life by giving 5 silver coins to a Kohen, and that process known as Pidyon HaBen is a festive occasion for the family and friends. There's a Seudat Mitzvah, a party, if you will, and it is done, provided it is the first issue of the mother's womb, provided that she is Jewish, of course, provided that she is not the daughter of a Kohen or a Levi. The firstborn of such a woman is exempt from Pidyon HaBen. So it's a firstborn, not even following a miscarriage. And the statistics, which if any of the listeners happen to know any that are semi-authoritative, I would like to have an idea, but there's speculation that Pidyon HaBen is not all that common. Each of us have heard of it from time to time, maybe have gone to a Pidyon HaBen, but it's not that common. Okay. It's the other two kinds of Bechor that I would like to relate to. There is Bechor Behemat Tahura, the firstborn male offspring of a kosher domesticated animal, cow, goat, and sheep. According to the rule of the Torah, at the moment of its birth, it is sacred. It is to be taken care of for the first 30 to 50 days of its life, depending on which animal, and then given to the Kohen of one's choice as a gift. The Kohen has the animal inspected for blemishes to see if it is worthy for the altar. If it is worthy for the altar, the Kohen must offer it in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, as a sacrifice called Bechor, and he eats from the meat of the Bechor, which he gets back with his family in Yerushalayim, B'Kedusha V'Tahara. If the animal is blemished and unfit for the Mizbeach, for the altar, then it belongs to the Kohen, free and clear, as we say, to do with it whatever he wants. He could raise it, he could benefit from it, etc., etc. Here's the problem. This mitzvah of the sanctity of a firstborn kosher domesticated animal applies not only in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, but today as well. What you will say? We don't have a Beit HaMikdash. We don't have the ability to bring korbanot. That is correct, and there's the problem. The mitzvah applies. If a Jew owns a female cow, and she is pregnant with her first offspring, and a calf is born, and it is male, that calf is kodesh, is sacred today. The person owning such an animal has to take care of that calf for 50 days and then give it as a gift to a Kohen as halacha requires. What is that Kohen supposed to do with that calf? That's the problem. He has to take care of it until he is able to bring it as a korban bechor to the Beit HaMikdash. And if it doesn't happen tomorrow or the next day, he has to keep taking care of the animal day after day, year after year, never ever benefiting from it. If it's a lamb, he can't shear the wool and use it, even to make tzitzis. No benefit at all. If he does shear the wool for the benefit of the animal, he has to bury the wool without anybody benefiting from it, because it's a sacred animal. So the Shulchan Aruch says, whoa, wait a minute. This is not a good situation. Here you have a mitzvah That's supposed to be a beautiful mitzvah, a gift to the Kohen, an offering to God, and the recipient Kohen benefiting from its meat with his family. That's the way it should be. It can't yet be like that, but the mitzvah still applies. Comes the code of laws and says, we're going to teach you how to avoid this mitzvah. And I stop here and I tell you, to me, how poignant this is, a statement in Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, it exists in order to encourage the Jew to do what he's supposed to do and prevent him from doing what he's not supposed to do. It is not supposed to tell him to avoid doing a mitzvah. But in this case, they have no choice. They say this would be a tremendous potential temptation for the Kohen to do away with the animal, to drive it out into the country and leave it, and let it wander around until somebody finds it or whatever, which you're not supposed to do, to inflict a blemish in it, which you're not supposed to do. Terrible consequences. Therefore, the Shulchan Aruch says, get out of this mitzvah. How does one do that? It's fairly simple. Before the animal is born, when the mother cow is still pregnant, you go to a non-Jew and say, got a deal for you. I'd like you to buy for one shekel, for one quarter, 25 cents, a tiny percent or a fraction of a percent ownership in this pregnant cow. Okay, here's the shekel, here's your quarter, I'm now a partner. An animal that is jointly owned by a Jew and a non-Jew, there is no sanctity to a firstborn. The calf is born, it's a boy, mazel tov, you've got a male calf, raise it, do what you want with it, it's yours, again, free and clear. No sanctity, no problem, but also no mitzvah. So yes, you have gotten out of a mitzvah, but you've gotten out of a mitzvah that our sages want you to get out of because of the difficulty in doing this mitzvah. But again, I say, isn't that sad? And that gives us cause to pray for a future when all mitzvot will be restored to their conditions where we are able to observe them properly. Next chapter deals with the firstborn of a donkey, the only firstborn of a non-kosher animal that has any sanctity, not really sanctity, but has any issue in this topic of Bechor. A firstborn donkey is not sacred. A firstborn donkey is forbidden to benefit from by the owner until one undergoes a process called Pidyon Peter Chamor, redemption of the firstborn donkey. You take a sheep, any age, either sex, any condition, and you give it as a gift to a Kohen, officially in exchange for this newborn donkey. Then the donkey becomes yours, and there's no problem. Comes the Shulchan Aruch and says, remember what I taught you in last chapter about the firstborn cow, goat, or sheep, about how you're supposed to get out of this mitzvah by becoming a partner with a non-Jew and the mother animal? Well, I have to tell you the truth, says Shulchan Aruch. If you do that with the donkey, it'll work. But I'm asking you, telling you, not to do it with the donkey. In other words, a person could say, hey, a sheep, I don't know what it goes for today in the market, but it costs some money. I could save myself a sheep by partnering for one shekel's worth with a non-Jew in the mother donkey. Yes, it'll work. It'll circumvent this mitzvah, which also applies in our time. But now the Shulchan Aruch says, don't do that, because this one doesn't have the problem. You don't need a Beit HaMikdash for this. You don't need a Mizbeach. The animal is not sacred. If you do this mitzvah, do it. Even though it'll cost you a sheep, it's still an important mitzvah to do, and then you'll be able to use the donkey as you were planning to in the first place. So it's an interesting 1-2 punch of Shulchan Aruch here, where on the one hand, with a heavy heart, it has to inform us that here is a mitzvah, and there are a few others like it, that applies in our time, but it is forbidden by rabbinic authority to do them because of the difficulties that they present. You cannot bring that mitzvah to its proper fruition and conclusion. In the case of Peter Chamor, the firstborn of a donkey, you could do it, so you should do it. And in Israel, there are, once in a while, you hear about it on the TV and radio, a Pidyon Peter Chamor, where people make a big fuss about it, they have live music and a buffet, and they invite people, and it's a whole simcha in fulfilling this fairly rare mitzvah to fulfill. That's all the time I have for now. On this note, I will wish you Shabbat Shalom and Chodesh Tov, Lehishtameah.